A real frontline patriot brings you his one-of-a-kind perspective on freedom versus tyranny. This is the world premiere of the Political Prisoner Podcast, powered by Gateway Pundit. Now, live from solitary confinement, here's your host, January Sixer, Jake Lang.
Hey, everybody. Welcome back to the Political Prisoner Podcast. It's your host, Jake Lang. Man, today we got a really special guest, one of the most intricately involved persons of the January 6th movement. Ivan Raiklin joins me today. Ivan's been moving and shaking in the congressional buildings, asking the right questions, learning the right information for the last over 2 years, 2 years and 9 months I've been incarcerated. So Ivan's been in this fight for a long time. It's a really great pleasure of mine to bring him on the show with me. Ivan's also been hosting a show on the Blessed News Network at 4 p.m. Eastern every single day on the blessednewsapp.com. So it's awesome to have us work in multiple ways together. Ivan Raiklin joins me now live. I'm in the D.C. gulag. Ivan, where are you at?
Hey, Jake. I'm not too far away from you. I'm in the Raiklin gulag. No, I'm joking. I mean, you guys are taking the brunt of the pain of the political persecution by Pelosi, Schumer, and the rest of the uniparty cabal, which I'm going to hopefully lay out and explain, depending on the time that we have, that McCarthy as well as McConnell were in on it along with Mike Pence, and why you guys are sitting and rotting in prison. And so hopefully I think next week is going to be a really big breaking point. But as you prepare for listening in on Chief Sun's testimony before the House Admin Committee next week, I think I want to – we were talking before you press record. I want to talk in detail about the sequence of events that – basically led us to January 6th that caused Nancy Pelosi and the Uniparty to do what they did on January 6th and then the subsequent cover-up and persecutions of every single J6, a cover-up of the Fed's direction coup and then the persecution of all, I think at this point, 1,200 J6 defendants.
Sure, brother. Yeah, we have plenty of time. We're going to be calling back periodically. We can take up to 45 minutes, an hour if you need. And everybody that's listening out there, Gateway Pundit and everywhere you're listening, really try to hone in, take some notes on what Ivan's about to explain because it's intricate, it's got details, but every single person in America needs to know about this mass cover-up and this scheme that the Uniparty, the Democrats, and the Rhino Republicans pulled off on January 6th, this coup d'etat. So, Ivan, take it away. Take us to the very beginning, the inception point of what people need to know about really the root cause of January 6th and how basically 980 days later, I'm still sitting in prison without a trial.
Right. So here's my perspective based on my investigating the whole situation. So back in December, about December 20th or 21st of 2020, I sent out a tweet titled Operation Pence Card. And in that tweet, there was an attached memo that was being circulated in the White House, essentially explaining that Mike Pence's role on December 23rd under the Electoral Count Act was that he was obligated to send back the electors from at a minimum 6 contested states and maybe even more to include New Hampshire and Nebraska, because all the states that conducted their elections, not according to the election law of that state, according to that legislature, those electors were transmitted illegitimately. So those electors were illegitimate, and then he would send it back to then give them an opportunity to go ahead and either hold a new election according to the election law, number two, abstain, or have a joint session of that legislative body, unless it was a Nebraska, then it would have been the unicameral, to hold a vote on determining how they would allocate their electors, considering that the elections were done under COVID rules that non-legislative actors promulgated, and then that would have corrected and remedied the underlying illegally conducted and then illegally transmitted electors. We all know that Mike Pence did absolutely nothing.
I was about to say, a lot of the responsibility fell in Mike Pence's lap to start this process, kind of the cascading effect of the election integrity, and it kind of falls in his lap at that point to send the votes back. Am I right?
Right. So a lot of people confuse his responsibility on January 6th with his responsibility on December 23rd, because the previous Electoral Count Act basically stated that on the fourth Wednesday of December, it was up to the president of the Senate, obviously Mike Pence at the time, to go ahead and, if he does not receive electoral slates from states, to send a demand letter to the secretaries of state or secretary of state, right, of the relevant states, demanding that they transmit a set of electors. The argument was that what was transmitted to the seat of federal government, the National Archivist and the President of the Senate, in December of 2020, those electors were not legitimate. They were not constitutionally sufficient because it, the manner in which they conducted the election to then allocate those electors went outside of the scope of Article 2, Section 1, Clause 2 of our federal constitution, which is the Electors Clause, where it's up to the state legislatures for them to decide on how they allocate their electors, not non-legislative actors, as was done in the 2020 election. Does that make sense so far?
Yeah, makes sense. I'm reading you loud and clear here. Now, I have a question for you. Who determines, who gets to decide that those legislatures were not in their right, you know, frame because of the new COVID, not, you know, the new COVID rules?
Yeah, so here's what happened in every single instance. For example, in Pennsylvania, the Supreme Court of Pennsylvania took it upon itself to go ahead and take away the constitutional authority that the state legislature had in Pennsylvania to allocate those electors. So they added certain measures saying that, oh, the drop boxes, the additional days that they're going to count the votes, it went outside of the state's own election law. So each state has – so up until the eighth, you know, the first few elections that occurred for president and vice president of the United States was done based on a vote of the legislature of the state. And then the state started to pass laws giving that – not authority, but delegating that to a popular vote.
Remaining.
Say that again.
So delegating. You want to pause now?
No, just finish your thought here, and then we'll wrap up.
Yeah. So delegate. So the state legislatures then delegated that authority to how they would allocate their presidential and vice presidential electors based on a popular vote of the state. Problem is, in 2020. The executive branch actors in different states decided how they were going to run the elections, which was outside of the election law, making it a completely illegitimate election in those states. And I'll pause there until we pick up again.
Thank you, Ivan. Guys, you're listening to the Political Prisoner Podcast. We'll be right back after these quick commercials. God bless everybody. Thanks for tuning in. Welcome back, everybody. It's Jake Lang with the Political Prisoner Podcast. Where are you guys listening today? Are you listening on Apple Podcast app and Spotify? If you want to subscribe and catch every single episode of the Political Prisoner Podcast, go to your Spotify app or your Apple Podcast app. Go to the search bar, type in Jake Lang, and you'll see the podcast, and you guys can subscribe and listen to all the episodes there. We're also live on the weekends, 8 p.m. Eastern, on the Blessed News Network. If you guys want to go to the app store, it's a free app. Just type in Blessed News and download that. And, of course, my Gateway Pundit listeners, we love you guys. Shout out to all of you. Share this article on Twitter and Getter and Truth and everywhere you can. We thank you guys so much. You guys are the best. All right, so we're back here with Ivan Raiklin. I'm in the D.C. gulag. He's not too far away. He's in the Ivan Raiklin gulag, his command center for election integrity and all of this really intricate, deep-diving work that he's doing. I would say – honestly, I know pretty much everybody in the Jan 6 movement. Ivan Raiklin's probably the foremost expert on the 2020 election and its implications to the January 6th event and the persecution thereafter. He's been active on Capitol Hill, talking to the right people. He's got some news for us today about, you know, why Kevin McCarthy can't put out the tapes that he's promised us, a little bit of background information on the 2020 election, the legislatures in the states were not properly slated, everybody, in at least six of the states to even hold those elections. They got changed. The COVID rules changed the game, and, you know, we're moving forward here from now. And we're trying to figure out how we can make sure the same mistakes don't happen in 2024. Everybody, Ivan Raiklin.
All right, Jake, thanks for having me. Part two here. So we left off basically explaining that I'm trying to do the run-up of why J6 happened and how I'm going to explain how that did happen. I think it was because in the run-up, you had Mike Pence basically was put on notice with that tweet that President Trump retweeted. And when Mike Pence did nothing, midnight came around on December 23rd under the Electoral Count Act, basically it then transitioned from the states had now illegally certified their elections, transmitted it. Mike Pence illegally allowed those electors to come through so that they would then be assessed by the federal Congress to determine whether or not they were going to accept those or not. Now, in the run-up to January 6th, my role was essentially, I was at that point communicating with members of Congress to explain to them they did not have to agree with anybody related to whether it was retail fraud, wholesale fraud, alternate slates. It didn't matter. It all came down to, at that point in January 6th, because that's what the states transmitted, they transmitted, and it was up to Kevin McCarthy in his role as the majority state delegation chair and Mike Pence as the presiding officer to determine between those two individuals whether or not they would vote on the objections for the states under the construct of a one-person, one vote, or a one-state-by-delegation vote in the House. Let me clarify this. So when January 6th rolls around, and I'm explaining to members of Congress saying that all you have to do is realize that the state did not conduct the election lawfully under their election law, and that triggers that Article 2, Section 1, Clause 2 violation. And as a federal officer, which Mike Pence didn't do in December, you are now afforded the opportunity in the joint session to do so to object to those. And as I was explaining it to people, on January 5th, we had reached the point where 147 members of the House and growing by the minute and 12 U.S. senators and growing by the minute had understood that that was the case and were publicly already said that they were going to object. So,
wow.
This is separate from anything else that's being litigated right now in the courts, in the court of public opinion, and everything that came out. In addition to that, in the background, again, this is me just basically talking with those that I know in Congress, incoming members. I've done numerous podcasts on who I've spoken to, probably nearly a dozen members of Congress, and then that was growing. And then so going into January 6th, I also – provided the following to Kevin McCarthy directly and to Mark Short, which is was the chief of staff for Mike Pence. This is the most important thing on why the Fed's erection have to happen. So I explained to Kevin McCarthy and to Mark Short, Mike Pence's chief of staff, saying that when it comes down to the objection period on the 6th, you have remember when Paul Gosar stands up and objects, and then Ted Cruz stands up and objects? Well, after that, the Senate goes to their chambers, and then the House remains, and then they go through a two-hour deliberation process, of which, at the end, there's a vote on whether or not the House is going to object or not to the Arizona electors. I explained that because the Electoral Count Act, which is the law that specifies exactly how that joint session is to take place, did not say how the House could and should or is mandated to vote. We fall back on the 12th Amendment, which is the only place within the federal Constitution that lists what goes on in the joint session. And since the 12th Amendment says that in a contingent election context, you vote one state, one vote, the Electoral Count Act doesn't mandate that you got to vote one person, one vote. It is up to the House to determine how it votes. So there's two options. You do one person, one vote by member of House, or you do a one state, one vote by state delegation. So example.
Now, which one, Ivan, were they leaning towards? I mean, it'd probably be better if they did the one state, one vote because they'd have the numbers then.
So the one person, one vote, at the time it was 222 Democrats and 212 Republicans. Okay? So Nancy Pelosi would have chosen the one person, one vote option, which they did, and then would have said, no, guess what? We vote, and the objection to Arizona is not sustained, and then they're going to go ahead and accept those electors. Now, Kevin McCarthy could have said, no, we're going to vote one state, one vote by delegation. And at that point, there were 27 states that had an R by them, by delegation, Republican, 20 states that were Democrat, and 3 states tied up. So imagine they go back into the joint session. Mike Pence, as presiding officer, gavels in and says, what's the ruling? Asks, what's the ruling on the objection for Arizona? Pelosi or her designate stands up and says, it's not sustained, meaning they accept the electors. And then Kevin McCarthy was to stand up and say, point of order, Mr. Presiding Officer. Actually, we vote one state, one vote. And then so then it would have been up to Mike Pence.
He had the authority. Kevin McCarthy had the authority to do that and did not do that. Explain that.
Yes.
What's up with
this has never been tested. This has never been tested in our nation's history, but there is room for that to take place because there's no requirement that the House votes one person, one vote. That's still unchanged. Even in the new Electoral Count Act, they did not address that. They never addressed that. So, which begs the question, had Kevin done that, then it would have been up to the presiding officer to determine, does he accept Nancy Pelosi's one person, one vote, or does he accept the Kevin McCarthy? And then he would lean over to Nancy Pelosi's parliamentarian and ask, what do you say? And then they would have said something, and Mike Pence, and I laid this all out, by the way, like basically the give and take. And so Mike Pence would have said, thank you, Mr. House parliamentarian, or thank you, House parliamentarian. And that's noted, but you are only binding on the House of Representatives when it's alone as a body. You are not binding on the joint session, of which I'm the presiding officer. And then he would lean over to the Senate parliamentarian and ask advice from the Senate parliamentarian, which would have told him that, you know, something. And Pence would have responded with, thank you for that advice, but you are only binding on my decision-making when I'm the president of the Senate in the Senate chambers. So then it's up to Mike Pence as the presiding officer on which style of vote he should go with. And then he could have used some argumentation such as, well, considering the Electoral Count Act is silent, the 12th Amendment talks about this one state, one vote mechanism in a contingent election. And based off of that, I am going to rely on the context and framing of the 12th Amendment as it applies to a contingent election. These are contested states. I'm going to go ahead and rule in favor of Kevin McCarthy, not making that binding. So that
this is all contingent upon Mike Pence actually having a spinal cord. So
this would have required Kevin McCarthy to initiate that for the entire House body to vote. And then when that took place, it would have been up to Mike Pence to make that decision. So it was not a unilateral decision for Mike Pence to do. It was a decision in the collective order of the entire U.S. House of Representatives voting by delegation, motivated by Kevin McCarthy to do so, and for Mike Pence to agree with that. Imagine that took place. Everyone votes by party. That means that Arizona, Pennsylvania, and Wisconsin at a minimum are objected to under that framework, triggering an overall contingent election, thus voting again on who the president should be in the House, and it would have been a 27-20-3 vote for Trump. And then the Senate at the time was still with Loeffler and Perdue, senators from Georgia, 52-48, would have been essentially in a position to have to reelect Pence for him to continue to be Donald Trump's handler for the second term on behalf of the Uniparty. That was what I had articulated, and I did it not only in the court of public opinion, but I also laid it out directly, sending the message out to those two individuals. Now, whether or not they read it, studied it, learned it, that is a question to ask them.
So now lead us through why this didn't happen and start to bring us into yes. January 6th, the actual events of what, you know, the theoretical events of what should have happened, we have now covered. Why didn't that happen? Why did Kevin McCarthy not do that? And lead us more now. Let's move this train along,
yes.
Because this is good. I hope the audience, I hope you guys
perfect.
Are listening, because I'm on the edge of my seat and my cell right now, which is actually my toilet. And I'm on the edge of my toilet right now.
Oh, man, I love the levity, man. No, so the reason why I frame this is if you know that this is taking place, i.e. Nancy Pelosi, what are your options considering that this may possibly take place, right? Because up until January 5th, the discussions that I've read and seen, that this was a possibility. So if you want to stop the exposure of an illegally conducted election and then the illegal certification by the states and then the illegal acquiescence by Pence to allow them through for January 6th, and then there's a possibility, there's literally a 50-50 shot for a re-election of Trump, what can you do as the Speaker of the House, the person in charge of the body that hosts the joint session?
Remaining.
I argue, yeah, so I argue that because Pelosi and the left side of things, right, the CCP Democrats, controlled big tech, controlled big media, and they had already controlled it to the point of censoring everybody, the only place that information could get out uncensored would be on C-SPAN. And the joint session was going to be broadcast on C-SPAN for the whole world to see and hear of the illegal conducted election and then the objections to take place. So what did Nancy Pelosi have to do? She had to launch January 6th Fedsurrection to stop the Ivan Raiklin recommended approach for McCarthy and Mike Pence to trigger a reelection. And we're going to get into details on how that took place in the next segment.
Wow. Wow, truly, truly a surreptitious act by Nancy Pelosi and the CCP Democrats. Thanks, Ivan. Guys, we're going to be right back after these commercials. You're listening to Political Prisoner. Hey, everybody, welcome back to the Political Prisoner Podcast. It's your host, Jake Lang. We are, flying through one of the most educational approaches to the January 6th debacle, the Fedsurrection, and the ensuing aftermath of the arrest of 1,200 January 6th patriots and unarmed American citizens who went to the Capitol to protest a stolen election, a coup d'etat by the communists bought and paid for, Joe Biden and the Democrats. We're here with Ivan Raiklin. We're blessed by the Lord God today to be here. Everybody, keep praying for the Jan 6ers. Remain faithful to Jesus Christ because he will get us through this. All things are possible through him who loved us. He is more than a conqueror, and we are more than conquerors through him. So, Ivan, we just got through two segments that I think a lot of people out there listening are probably really upset and angry right now that not only did the December 23rd action to kind of stop this election debacle, the stolen election, not go through, but then on January 6th, the Ivan Raiklin approach to have the Kevin McCarthy object and try to bring it to a one-state, one-vote solution did not go through. So take us, what actually happened on January 6th, and what's, you've seen all the videos, you know the nitty-gritty details. Give the American people an insider's look on January 6th.
All right, so based on what didn't transpire, initially my thoughts were, oh, wow, folks got rowdy and then were angry and then rolled in. That was my initial, that was the initial reports that were coming out. And then since then, I've just been investigating, spending easily thousands of hours at this point, trying to identify what's been going on. And the biggest gap, so my background, I spent 25 years in our national security apparatus. And the biggest thing that I noticed in all the media and everybody's attention, the information gap, the biggest one in my opinion, was any sort of scrutiny on the legislative actors at the senior most level and on down within as it applies to J6, meaning most people have no clue about what the Capitol Police Board is. Most people don't know how that construct is set up and where the leverage points are. Well, as I started to dig in, I thought to myself, who was in charge at the Capitol? And then who are their bosses, et cetera? So it comes down to this. My hypothesis based on – and I had literally have not found no evidence to be inconsistent with this – is that Nancy Pelosi, based on what I described, had to spring into action, activate Yogananda Pittman, the head of Intelligence and Interagency Coordination Division within U.S. Capitol Police, in order to, based on, at a minimum, inaction, create the frame and the context on January 6th so that people could easily enter the Capitol, the objections would be stopped, the media would focus its attention to include her daughter, who was right next to her, quote-unquote, doing a documentary, and her son-in-law on the outside of the Capitol that day, coordinating from the outside the media hype, in order to divert an illegal election to an actual, oh, look, people are breaching the Capitol, okay? Now, a couple of things I want to note, a lot of people still don't understand.
But focus in, Ivan, give me 1 second here. Audience, focus in on this lady, Yogananda Pittman. She was basically the assistant chief of police of the Capitol Police that day, and she's kind of the apparatus that Nancy Pelosi used because she was the head of the intelligence division of the chief of the Capitol Police. And so she's really a lot of the reason why January 6th transpired the way it did. She's one of the people that is the instrument of the Democrats to actually put together the right set of environment and the right circumstances for January 6th to transpire. Am I right there?
Yeah, so I argue, and again, this is my personal assessment. Based on my background, evidence collection, which we were not going to have time to go into every single piece of evidence, but I have a high level of confidence. I'm almost certain that Pelosi directed Yogananda Pittman, her daughter Alexandra, her son-in-law Michael Voss, to go ahead and ensure that John Sullivan was the inner breach team leader for January 6th, and Ray Epps was the outer breach team leader. And that's why you saw Michael Voss meeting. Michael Voss is the son-in-law of Pelosi, by the way. He was meeting at the W Hotel. I have two witnesses that saw him meeting with John Sullivan at noon at the W Hotel just north of Freedom Plaza. And then a few hours later, John Sullivan is then meeting with Ray, or not meeting, but standing right next to Ray Epps as he's yelling to attack the Capitol the next day. Additionally, the RNC and the DNC, while Ray Epps was talking about attacking the Capitol, the RNC and DNC there's a pipe bomb, an inert pipe bomb placed there, and it's within the jurisdiction of U.S. Capitol Police concurrently with D.C. Metro. This is important. So if you're the head of IICD, Yogananda Pittman, there's really and you're basically coordinating with the mayor of D.C. through her Metropolitan Police Chief, Conti, who's now the number three guy over at the FBI, oddly enough. Isn't that a coincidence? It's not too hard to go ahead and place these devices there and then make it look like it was a legitimate threat, okay? And so
to draw the attention and draw the resources of the Capitol Police over towards those areas so that the Capitol was less fortified. Am I right there?
Right. So there was decision-making. Exactly. There was decision-making done at the strategic level, meaning the mayor of D.C. and Nancy Pelosi, both in a coordinated fashion on January 5th, basically in the morning, Bowser tweets out, no executive branch support for January 6th. And then you had terms such as due to optics, we're not going to accept any extra additional support, whether it's National Guard, DOD, DHS, DOJ, executive branch actors. And so you heard people like, oh, I don't know, Nancy Pelosi saying due to optics. The House Sergeant at Arms, Paul Irving, says due to optics, we're not going to provide additional support to Chief Sund, who was requesting six times additional support for January 6th. And then Yogananda Pittman is sitting on 21 TD-159, which is the intelligence report that basically said that there was going to be a breach of the Capitol. And that wasn't provided to Chad Thomas, the other acting police chief, nor was it provided to the chief of police, Chief Sund. So you have intentionally, they're trying to leave the Capitol completely unguarded so that Ray Epps is literally free to do whatever he wants in instigating an already irate crowd, and then that irate crowd basically blows a gasket when Mike Pence tweets out at 1:02 p.m. that he is going to be a toxic, feckless, stone-cold, gutless, coward simp and essentially watch and observe as the illegally conducted election is going to be subsequently illegally certified under his watch. I'm going to pause there.
Say it louder for the people in the back, Ivan. Say it louder for the people in the back. You guys listening? This is how an election is stolen and a narrative is created to implicate Donald Trump and his supporters to cover up their coup d'etat and hand over the election to another gutless simp, God bless his heart and soul, Joe Biden. This is how we were used as pawns on January 6th. The American people, the Trump supporters, the good-hearted, brave patriots that stood up on January 6th, their bravery never discounted, were also used as a political hockey puck by the Democrats to ensure that they got away with the stolen election. They only had just a few more hoops to jump through to make sure that their evil, orchestrated attempt and successful attempt to steal the 2020 election was completely covered up and they got their man in office. And the last day of this entire psychological and, you know, coup d'etat-like operation was finally completed. They crossed their T's and dotted their I's, and they got done the job. And we were their last step in the ladder here.
So let me say this, so too, Jake. On that day, I argue, based on what I've seen, is all of the election justice rally attendees, the legitimate ones, as well as almost all U.S. Capitol Police, were duped into this total chaos, facilitated unlawful entry into the Capitol. And they were duped and manipulated by those that were in charge of essentially framing it. Those individuals that blocked any additional support to protect the Capitol, which would have been Pelosi, which would have been McConnell and his staff, right? Because he was the Senate Majority Leader. Keep in mind that you cannot bring in executive branch, really anybody, onto the Capitol complex without the request and approval by the Speaker of the House and or the Senate Majority Leader, depending on what side of the Capitol that executive branch entity or individual is going to be at. Now, if you're Nancy Pelosi and you're tight with the Intel and Interagency Coordination Division Assistant Capitol Police Chief, Yogananda Pittman, and you need to conduct a Fed's direction coup, all you have to do is ask her to say, you know what, sit on any intel. If you do what I ask you to do, we're going to elevate you to be the acting police chief, and you're going to be able to be the police chief of the Capitol. We'll remove Steve Sund if you can make it look like he conducted a failure that day. Well, guess what? She did just that. And in addition to that, I don't have a high confidence level in this component of it, but what needs to be scrutinized is what communications did Pittman have with Pelosi, with the Sergeant-at-Arms Irving and the House Sergeant-at-Arms, the Senate Sergeant-at-Arms Stenger, and then as it applies to and also the DNC pipe bomb emplacement and the RNC pipe bomb emplacement. I suspect we're going to find out some interesting information.
Let me stop you right here, Ivan. Let me stop you right here quickly. This is the fact that these questions were not asked in the January 6th Select Committee congressional hearing. What it was such a sham and such a diversion tactic, them just showing the videos of, you know, the Jan 6ers defending their lives and trying to protect it. There's a reason why these questions were not asked by, you know, Liz Cheney and, you know, the whole entire ilk of them.
Yeah,
it's
Mike
because
Pence
they were trying to cover it up
Liz
even
Cheney.
Further. I mean,
exactly.
Yes. Why weren't
so
these questions
explain.
Asked? And why aren't the Republicans doing a new one?
Right. So if it was a covert action conducted by the legislative branch on the Capitol grounds, of which basically they can do, and there's no mechanism to really expose it, as we just saw, the reason
you
being
have
is that guess
one
who the staff,
minute remaining.
I'm going to end with this, with the last minute here on this segment. the staff director, meaning the senior most staffer on the Mike Pence J6 cover-up committee headed up by his running mate Liz Cheney. Guess who the name of that staff director was? His name was David Buckley. David Buckley was the former inspector general at the Central Intelligence Agency. But here's the more important component of it. He was one of the 51 former named intelligence officers that said that the Biden criminal syndicate laptop had all the earmarks of a Russian disinformation campaign. The same guys that covered for Biden ran that James 6 cover-up committee.
It's the levels this is the real House of Cards. I know everyone watched the Netflix version, but this is the real House of Cards. This is the real DC swamp. Everybody, welcome back to the Political Prisoner Podcast. It's your host, Jake Lang. I'm coming to you live from the DC Gulag. The events of January 6th have so many different levels to them. You know, you have the surface level, what the mainstream media reported and what the January 6th Select Committee, the FARS Committee, reported on and showed the American people. And then you have all these deeper levels, all these bad actors, all of this Washington, D.C. swamp, interconnectivity, Yogananda Pittman and Nancy Pelosi and Capitol Chief, the Chief of Police, and all of these people that are interconnected and have some culpability of the events of January 6th, that they were orchestrated and set up to cover up the stolen election. The foremost expert, I believe, probably in the world on this event and the cover-up and how all these people are connected is here with me. Ivan Raiklin's an investigative reporter, just an absolute juggernaut of the January 6th movement. He's got a new show on the Blessed News Network, 4 p.m. every single weekday. If you guys want to tune in, he does an awesome job on there, too. He joins me. He's been breaking it down. I think that last segment may have totally blown some people's tops off, Ivan. That was incredible, the way that we've connected all these dots here. Continue for the American people who are probably going to listen to this interview two or three times to fully get a real comprehensive understanding of what happened and just how insidious this Democrat Party and their leaders have been into duping the American people. Tell us more.
Yeah, so if you want me to go into the full version of this, it's probably a five-hour whiteboard, chalkboard, if you will, but I'm trying to give the highlights right now over the course of this hour. So bottom line, we finished off on it. Why the cover-up? So all of these cover-ups and the illegally conducted election really goes back to back to 2016 when the illegal spying and the defrauding of the FISA court occurred over at the FBI when they went ahead and spied on the Carter Page, right? And then ever since then, there's been cover-up after escalating cover-up, which basically I thought was going to end somewhat with the temporary coup d'etat on January 6th, but we see it continuing to escalate. Now, cover-up. We want to talk about basically how they've been able to cover up the illegally conducted, illegally certified election. It's because there were so many people involved in it at the highest levels that they now have to deploy the DOJ, both political parties, to protect what they just stole, what they just did. And so when I say that, I mean, when you go back to January 6th at 1 p.m., when Nancy Pelosi gavels in as a Speaker of the House, she says that only 11 members of the Democrat Party and then Republican Party on the House side can participate, as well as 11 on the Senate side for the Democrats and the Republicans. That's based on the advice of the attending physician, the two sergeants at arms, and with the agreement of leadership. Well, leadership means Mitch McConnell, Chuck Schumer, and Kevin McCarthy. So in essence, there was no quorum that took place on January 6th. There was not a sufficient 12th Amendment quorum, so the J6 certification was unlawful as well. And then later on, when she hands it over to Mike Pence agrees that he's not going to allow more than the 11 members from each party, from each of the bicameral institutions, the House and the Senate. Even though Congressman Morgan Griffith called him out trying to ask, how are we supposed to participate in doing a point of order or a parliamentary inquiry if, according to Nancy Pelosi, a majority of us, meaning over 90% of the members of Congress, can't even participate? And Mike Pence says, objections aren't allowed, so go ahead and sit down. And then later on that day, Mike Pence is prancing around with his chest out, beating it like a drum, and says, I am now the acting commander-in-chief, even though the Constitution only allows him to do so if he invokes the 25th Amendment with the cabinet to remove the president, take the role of commander-in-chief, to order the National Guard around, and then General Milley also somehow receives this unlawful order, not in the chain of command of the commander-in-chief, and then goes ahead and solidifies the coup d'etat with the 9 months surrounding of the Capitol to protect the steel. Mind you, the Secretary of the Army, Ryan McCarthy, I think was also one of the folks that said, due to optics, along with Nancy Pelosi's due to optics and Mayor Bowser's due to optics and Paul Irving, the House Sergeant at Arms, due to optics, they weren't going to defend the Capitol. But now all of a sudden, due to optics, they're going to protect the steel. So that's what's going on externally. The media is amplifying it and stoking flames and fire. And then the J6 cover-up committee goes into full court press with this guy, David Buckley, at the helm to make sure that John Brennan and all the other 60 that signed off that the Biden criminal syndicate laptop had all the earmarks of a Russian disinformation campaign, they go into high gear to criminalize anybody, and anyone or entity that is about to prove that the 2020 election was lawless, that the plandemic was a plandemic, that the FBI was involved in the cover-up after cover-up after cover-up, starting with Crossfire Hurricane, the illegal spying on Trump campaign by the head individuals in that organization doing it, which was Brian Auten, who later became – he still is the Foreign Influence Task Force lead doing the censorship scheme with Big Tech, along with his buddies at the San Francisco field office of the FBI, Joe Pienta III, who was the senior supervisory special agent on Crossfire Hurricane initially, sitting with Peter Strzok as they were interviewing General Flynn to get him to lie or to get him fired, according to the deputy assistant director of the FBI, Bill Priestap, at the time. And oh, by the way, the general counsel at the FBI at the time, who signed off on Crossfire Hurricane to spy on Trump, later became Twitter 1.0's general counsel, basically, in order to coordinate the censorship scheme as it applied to COVID, as it applied to the shots, as it applied to the election. Everyone that was censored because of basically Joe Pienka, Elvis Chan, Brian Auten, Jim Baker, and then Christopher Ray Epps, right? Now, going back to J6 committee, they were doing it on the J6 committee side of things, where you had Mike Pence's running mate, Liz Cheney, basically carrying water to protect the illegitimate actors that probably were involved as part of the Fed-coordinated assets on the Capitol grounds to instigate, and who would have been the one at Capitol Police that would have known which federal actors were allowed to participate in the instigation of the breach of the Capitol. It would have been the head of the Intel and Interagency Coordination Division, wouldn't you think, Jake? A gal by the name of
Yogananda Pittman.
Yes. So it'll be interesting to read her transcribed testimony, because she went before the House Admin Committee for 7 hours. And oh, by the way, I suspect that some things were mentioned in those 7 hours. And I suspect next week, by the way, breaking news yesterday, last night, Congressman Barry Loudermilk, he chairs the Subcommittee on Oversight, House Administration Committee, the committee charged with providing oversight over the Capitol Police and the Capitol Police Board. They're calling in former Chief of Capitol Police Steve Sund to testify. I suspect there's going to be some bombshell information that's going to expose Yogananda Pittman, the general counsel of the Capitol Police, which is Tad Tobias, a name that every J6 defendant needs to know. All of your attorneys need to know and contact him in order for him to provide all evidence, documents that were used as part of your criminal prosecution. So here's where I'm going to go into kind of like how it applies to all J6 defendants. So this is how it started. A officer saw that a potential transgression occurred on the Capitol grounds. They wrote up a criminal report. That criminal report went up, and then it went up to the Capitol Police Chief. Guess what? January 8th to July 23rd, that Capitol Police Chief would have been Yogananda Pittman. And then the general counsel would have basically advised on what charges to file as it relates to the fact pattern provided by the Capitol Police officer that wrote up the arrest. And then they took the CCTV footage, and then they created a new capability at Capitol Police, IICD, to scrub the internet social media of individuals that were arrested to see if there was any vocal public support for Trump. And the more vocal the support for Trump and the more proximate they were to President Trump, the more political persecution they were going to receive, regardless of whether or not there was a transgression committed. So I suspect that the Oath Keepers and the Proud Boys were going to be convicted, and I should say arrested for something, no matter what happened that day, because they had to create this narrative of this insurrection in order to divert from the actual seditious co-conspirators, Mike Pence, right? Pelosi, Schumer, McConnell, McCarthy, and then all involved in the J6 cover-up committee, and then the Capitol Police Board and the Capitol Police Chief. They basically ran this coup and then have been covering it up ever since. Problem is, they didn't realize that some folks like the wild cards were going to come out and start to investigate them. Like, oh, I don't know. I think his name's Ivan Raiklin, for one. And then you have J6 political prisoners that have a lot of time on their hands to go ahead and do their own due diligence and investigations and create podcasts and then coordinate the effort, like Jake Lang, to go ahead and start scrutinizing every single leader within the Capitol Police, such as the three most important people that need to be scrutinized full stop in Capitol Police: Yogananda Pittman, one, the general counsel of the U.S. Capitol Police, Tad Tobias, and then number three, the replacement Capitol Police Chief, who was voted in as the Capitol Police Chief in July of 2021, Thomas Manger, who still is the Capitol Police Chief, and he was placed there by the Capitol Police Board, which consists of, you just need two of three voting members to vote for you. Well, guess who the two of the three that I'm thinking of? Nancy Pelosi's sergeant-at-arms was the sergeant-at-arms back in July of 21, and Chuck Schumer's sergeant-at-arms, who's still the sergeant-at-arms over at the Senate for Chucky Schumer, as the chairman of the Capitol Police Board. And so those two individuals, meaning Schumer and Pelosi, appointed the current Capitol Police Chief. Do you think that Kevin McCarthy, now that he's appointed an acting House Sergeant-at-Arms, has the leverage with one vote against two other votes now?
You have 1 minute remaining.
Whether it's the architect of the Capitol now leaning left and the Senate Sergeant-at-Arms, who's the Schumer lackey, Kevin McCarthy does not have the leverage through his one Sergeant-at-Arms to force the Capitol Police Chief and the general counsel, Tad Tobias, to release all the J6 footage. The only way he can do that is we have to expose and remove the Capitol Police Chief. And the way we do that is through the House Admin Committee. And that's going to start to unravel next week as Chief Sun testifies before that committee. And I'm going to be writing up a Substack this weekend explaining what he should talk about and what each member of Congress on that committee needs to ask him.
Ivan, this has been exculpatory, voluminous, amazing. Great job today laying it out for the people. Rewatch this podcast. Share it to all your friends. Ivan, we're going to have you back on to give more synopsis.